This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. This year, the heat has been global and records broken across continents. In a clear sign the planet is warming, the five hottest years on record have all come in the last 7 years.
Keep in mind, we do have that heat warning in effect for North Texas, so if you're headed up to Dallas today, they're looking for high temperatures of 108 to 110 degrees. That is the actual air temperature.
In this year of 2018, climate heat, fires, floods, and violent storms have commandeered billions of lives for a new duty to the future, a duty to survive. Welcome back to Radio EcoShock in this fall season. I'm Alex Smith, returning to my own duty here in the studio. It's a new season of the best climate scientists, big picture experts, and activists I can find. We need it all. Next week, we'll start on the major climate science released this summer. Dr. Will Steffen will join us from Australia as humans hope to steer to a safer climate harbor before going over the edge into hothouse Earth. The guests do most of the talking on Radio EcoShock. I'm just the facilitator. And later in this program, we will speak with Roy Scranton about his new book, We're Doomed, Now What? But first, I want to share the horror stories from around the world as climate-driven extreme events struck down this summer. Nobody alive or dead has ever seen anything like what just happened in the past few months. No human has ever lived with carbon dioxide levels this high in the atmosphere. And that carbon load continues to climb as motorized life and fossil-powered electricity spread across the globe. The human cloud of greenhouse gases finds a new echo as forests release their carbon content on every continent. Here in British Columbia, on the west coast of Canada, we had our second year of fire emergency. Over 700 large fires burned through the mountains. Gigantic, out-of-control blazes lit up the night, and then they buried the whole sky with thick smoke, turning the day into night. Thousands were evacuated, turning on their vehicle headlights at 10 in the morning. Our annual family camping trip to a nearby lake in the mountains was smoked out. I stayed inside for a few weeks with HEPA air purifying filters running 24/7. Two fires popped up within a few miles of the Radio EcoShock studio. We had our photos and clothes packed ready to evacuate. I wasn't sure I would be in the studio this week to make a program for you. Thick smoke was blown down into Vancouver and Seattle and Portland. Then it blew right back across the whole continent, thousands of miles across the prairies and into Ontario and even New York State. Of course, that smoke was rained out in the east, where a series of strange storms stoked up with alternating high heat and hard-to-bear humidity, and then little bits of unseasonable cold snaps. Nobody in North America got a free pass to enjoy the summer. And that's the thing. During my life, summer was the time of good weather you could count on, except for the occasional thunderstorm. Now, in the age of climate change, summer is the season to survive. When I was growing up, old people told me they feared the winter. More old men and women died during the cold weather. Now, in the new climate times, the lore has changed. Old people should fear the summer, along with children and babies. And that's true with the heat deaths this summer in Canada in 2018, and in the mass heat deaths in Europe in 2003. From Australia to California to Pakistan, we will dread the coming of summer. Think about that. Okay, before we get to our guests, let's do a rapid-fire tour of some of the wild extreme headlines around the world in this first year of serious climate change. It came wherever you live, and I'll cover as much as time allows. At one point in July, the whole northern hemisphere seemed ablaze. It may be the first transcontinental fire ever seen. Fires raged in most of western North America, in the Arctic, in Sweden, Germany, Greece, Russia, Georgia, Japan, even Australia, where it's supposed to be winter. A global fire mapping service just blared red all over. Meanwhile, in Africa, the annual crop burning, and in the Amazon and in Indonesia, slash and burn to expand agriculture added to the planetary pulse of carbon into the atmosphere. It was all in the same 2 weeks of July. Probably you heard about the massive and deadly fires in California this summer. There are lots of media in California and lots of money in that state. Radio EcoShock also has quite a few stations in California. The situation there began with absolute record-breaking heat. July 2018 was the hottest month ever recorded in California. It was day after day of temperatures above 100 degrees F or 38 degrees C, and then over 110 degrees Fahrenheit, over 43 C. Like the fires, that heat spread around the northern half of the world. The roof of the Science Center in Glasgow, Scotland, melted and flowed down the walls. Roads melted all over. Ireland found its highest ever recorded temperature on June 28th.
Greece is dealing with the worst wildfires it's seen in more than a decade. At least 74 people have died so far, and authorities say they expect the death toll to rise as they search burned-out homes. Nearly 200 others have been injured, including 23 children.
Yerevan, the capital of Armenia, hit a new record of 107.6 degrees. Nighttime temperatures remained high, which is very dangerous for human health. Several places in the south of Russia beat their all-time heat records. According to the Capital Weather Gang at the Washington Post, Tbilisi, Georgia, also set their all-time high on July 4th with 104.9 degrees or 40.5 degrees Celsius. This is what climate change is about. The Arctic is supposed to be the world's refrigerator, but on July 18th, far northern Finland, at 70 degrees north, hit 33 degrees C or 91 degrees Fahrenheit. All of Scandinavia was rocking hot. And, of course, Sweden had so many forest fires they had to call in firefighters from around the world. Canada was roasting. Toronto had 18 days over 30 degrees C in the high 80s, double what used to be normal. The morgue in Montreal went over capacity for the first time ever with 84 killed by high heat. Both Montreal and the Canadian capital of Ottawa set all-time record extreme combinations for heat and humidity at midnight. Hot, humid nights don't just cost sleep, they kill. The world's highest nighttime low temperature ever was 109 degrees Fahrenheit, 42.7 degrees C, and that was set in Oman on the Persian Gulf this July. Or take northern Siberia, where it's supposed to be cold. On July 5th, temperatures were 40 degrees F above normal, or well above 90 degrees or 32 degrees C. And that's above the Arctic Circle, and that's nuts. The hottest temperature ever recorded in Africa, and that's saying something, was recorded July 5th in Algeria's Sahara Desert. It has to be confirmed still, but it was registered at 51 degrees C or 123.8 degrees Fahrenheit. That sounds like another planet, one closer to the sun, but now it's our planet.
Now, people across Japan have been urged to take precautions against a heat wave that has killed about 30 people. Thousands more have sought hospital treatment for heat-related conditions. Temperatures reached 40 degrees in central Japan earlier this week, the highest for 5 years.
And Japan. Let's talk about Japan for a minute. That country began the summer with an extreme rainfall event which the government called historic. Hundreds of thousands of people had to evacuate. Over 30 inches of rain fell within 2 days. Hundreds died. Rivers overflowed to drown cities and landslides blocked out the emergency help. As tens of thousands of emergency workers did arrive, they became the next victims as unbelievable heat buried Japan. Dozens died and hospitals filled up as temperatures went over 40 degrees C with more than 100 Fahrenheit. In the third week of that heat wave, on Monday, July 23rd, the highest temperature ever recorded in Japan arrived about 40 miles northwest of Tokyo. It was 106 degrees Fahrenheit or 41.1 degrees C. That is the 1-2 punch climate scientists and activists have feared and warned about. Japan suffered never-before-seen rains, followed immediately by weeks of emergency-level heat. Those are combinations that could eventually wear down an economy and civilization itself. And we see those combinations all over. As temperatures soared, health emergencies clogged the hospitals, and then the hospitals needed to be evacuated due to the following wildfires, as happened in California. As we move towards our guest interview, I'll just add one more sort of minor factor that you will never hear in an intergovernmental panel report or government planning. It's the fact that a small number of humans thrive on disaster and want to play a part in it. And no, I'm not talking about the disaster capitalists. As I was surrounded by wildfires here in the studio, I was collecting news stories, and rising out of that collection was an alarming fact. Arson is often part of the emergency, and so part of the carbon burst as well. Dateline, California. A suspect was arrested July 26th in the Monster Cranston fire east of Los Angeles that emptied Idlewild. California. The suspect in the Holy fire that caused 20,000 people to evacuate sent a text warning, "The place is going to burn." Greece. Deputy Minister warns there are serious indications of arson in one of the fires that killed more than 80 people there in July. As Mountain High Denver hit 90 degrees, over 32 degrees C, for the first 20 of those 24 days of July, police arrested a man for starting the spring fire with about 108,000 acres or 43,000 hectares burned. And you may not find out it's arson until years later. Canadian police announced that 29 fires set in the Okanagan Valley of British Columbia were set by an arsonist over the past 4 years. That was unsettling news. There were arsonists in Australia's bushfires over the years as well. According to the Journal of the American Academy of Psychiatry, over 62,000 arson fires are set in the U.S. every year. An article in the UK Guardian found arson is one of the world's fastest growing crimes, up 135% in Britain from 1990 to the year 2000. Quoting from the Guardian, around half of all arsonists are males under 18. The majority of the rest are males under 30, end quote. These young males often like being outdoors and set fires nearby. Some are mentally unfit or have brain damage. Some hope to be heroes fighting the blaze. Here in British Columbia, the vast majority of wildfires are started by natural lightning. Then we have vehicle fires, including from all-terrain vehicles. I guess you could say those are self-inflicted wounds increased by global warming. But as the climate heats up and dries out the forests, we can expect a small number of humans finding themselves capable of huge damage by trying to burn it all down, the new climate terrorists. Be aware. You could say our next guest, Dr. Roy Scranton, has been to hell and back, except it's hard to say where hell begins and ends sometimes. He's the author of several books, many about war. Before getting his English doctorate at Princeton, Roy wrote for publications, including blunt blogs in the New York Times. Those pieces tied his experiences in the Iraq War with his awakening to our climate-damaged future. Roy Scranton, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me on, Alex.
So, Roy, if you were concerned earlier in your life about social causes, why did you join the military and end up on the ground in one of the, I would say, unjust wars of this century?
That's a great question, and it's one I hear a lot because I was an activist in my 20s, and, you know, now I'm an English professor. And it's an unusual trajectory for someone with those elements in their background. But there's a lot of reasons why joining the Army made sense at that moment. First of all, I come from a working class military family. So the military was sort of always on the table as a career option in a way that it's not for a lot of people. I just grew up in that cross-section of American culture. So I rebelled against that, I guess, by being more of an activist. In my 20s, what happened was I was a college dropout at that point, and I was living in Moab, Utah, and, you know, I'd had a bike accident, and I messed up my teeth, and I couldn't get them fixed because I didn't have any health insurance. I was working a minimum wage job. A friend died in the community there, and then September 11th happened, and it sort of threw me into a spin. And at that point, I moved back to Oregon, where I'm from, and was looking at my options and thinking about what to do, and kept seeing this drumbeat for war on TV. It was clear we were in Afghanistan at that point. It was clear we were going into Iraq. So there was a combination of factors that sort of congealed at that moment that made joining the Army make sense. I wanted some dental care, right? I wanted some health care. I had to get myself together financially and, you know, in terms of organizing my life. I wanted to go back to school. But as well, I could see 9/11, you know, the events of September 11th had really changed the world as I understood it, right? It changed America's relations in the world. I could see that it changed the direction events were moving. And I didn't understand. I knew I didn't know what that meant exactly or where it was headed. I wanted to go and see what it looked like. And I did. George Orwell has always been a hero of mine. And one of the reasons why that's the case is because he didn't just depend on, you know, he did his research. He would interview people and he would, you know, read up on a subject. But he also just put himself in the middle of his subjects to try to understand what was happening, like with the Spanish Civil War or, you know, working as a dishwasher in Paris. And I wanted to put myself on the outer reaches, I guess, of American empire and see what was happening and what it meant.
Years later, in 2013, you wrote the New York Times article, Learning How to Die in the Anthropocene, and the Anthropocene is a new geologic age proposed by scientists where humans are driving some planetary processes now. And you compared your entry into Iraq after shock and awe to our developing future. What did you see in that war zone that could be in our future?
What I saw in Baghdad and Iraq more broadly was the collapse of infrastructure in the face of massive destruction and the probably deliberate or possibly just incompetent intervention of military and U.S. state actors in that situation in a way that left everyone worse off. And then the emergence out of that kind of constructed anarchy of virulent religious sectarianism, horrific violence, and vast suffering. So what I saw, to sort of condense that, what I saw was the failure of, you know, what we think of as civilization, right, on a small scale, in the face of catastrophic disaster, the failure of the military and government institutions we depend on to come in and create order in a situation like that. And then the emergence of local, unelected, increasingly more and more violent leaders in this kind of political vacuum. I think that's probably what we're looking at, right, in the future. Like, it's a small example of, I think, what we're going to increasingly see and what we're seeing. Actually, it's not as if it's in the future. We saw it in Katrina. We saw it with Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico. You know, there's a combination here of failing infrastructure and increasingly unmanageable disasters and a kind of, you know, what Naomi Klein called disaster capitalism, a kind of governmental and corporate and military approach that feeds on and encourages that disaster. Baghdad was a vision, I guess, of the future that I think we're going to see more and more often all over the world.
Do you think that proximity to death on a daily basis in a war zone helped eliminate a social veneer in you that might be steering you away from false hopes about climate change?
Yeah, that might be one way to describe it. It's funny, though. You know, I think about when I talk to or see on Twitter or engage with a lot of, you know, my fellow writers and journalists who are writing about climate change or activists and sometimes even scientists who have been for a long time advocating that we need to, you know, we can do this. We just need to keep fighting. It seems to me that those voices are growing increasingly frenetic and increasingly shrill, and they also sound more and more to me like the generals, the U.S. generals who were in charge of the occupation in Iraq and the U.S. generals in charge of the occupation in Afghanistan, right? These generals who insist that things are going great, we just need to stay the course and it's going to work out. But that's just self-delusion, right? That's just them telling themselves that and telling the people who they feel responsible to that they're invested in a certain narrative that things have to turn out a certain way because the possibility that they could turn out some other way is simply not something we can face. So I think we're in a similar situation, right, with catastrophic anthropogenic global warming. A lot of people believe that, and I'm not even talking about like the right-wing climate change deniers who are just, to me, they're like intellectual scum. They are in the worst bad faith and they're horrible people. But I'm talking about people with whom I would share a lot of, sort of progressive, general progressive ideas and views on things. I think there's a lot of denial because actually facing the possibility that we've lost this fight and that it's in the end game now, it's not something they're willing to face. They're not willing. They just can't. We just can't accept what that means, right? I think that's an obstacle to us thinking through what comes next.
Well, we're going to get into more of that as we get to your new book, We're Doomed, Now What? But I want to, first of all, ask you a little bit more about this military angle because, well, for example, James Clapper is a former director of national intelligence, and he was just in the news after President Trump took away his national security clearance for political reasons. But in 2013, James Clapper predicted the extremes of climate change would force mass migrations, riots, and civil chaos. And it got me thinking, how long has the military known that climate change will become the master threat and not terrorism?
Well, that's an interesting question that I have to admit I don't actually know the answer for. I do know that some lead movers and shakers in the military have been focused on climate change as a national security threat to some degree over the past 10 years, and perhaps even before then. They're not approaching it in terms of, you know, how do we stop it or what do we, you know, how do we mitigate. They're approaching it strictly as a security issue, what the military calls a force multiplier, maybe, you know, that it makes things worse, right? And it's going to drive conflict and it's going to create unstable security situations and emergent threats and so on. And it's also going to affect, right, bases like New Fork News and naval bases all over the world. It's really going to threaten American security infrastructure. So that's been a real concern. Also a real concern is the fact that the U.S. military runs on oil and, you know, how that dependence on oil relates to climate change and relates to possibly, you know, other emergent energy regimes, you know, based around solar or what have you, that has become an increasing issue as well. One thing that's interesting is that the last national security planning document, so the first one under the Trump administration, has omitted, it's just basically scrubbed climate change from discussion, and it's now focused primarily on China and Russia as state actors and the control of energy, right, as a serious political and security concern, but it doesn't really talk about climate change in the same way that the last few policy planning documents have.
In that 2013 New York Times blog, you said, quote, "We have to learn how to die not as individuals, but as a civilization." And that got my immediate inside brain reaction of, well, who are you to proclaim the death of our civilization?
Just an interested observer. So here's the deal, right? The civilization that we live in runs on oil, right? And coal and natural gas, primarily oil. If you think about plastics and you think about shipping and you think about just the way our world, the human world that we live in, is connected and dependent on cheap oil for energy and cheap oil as a substance for construction, and then the way that that affects the networks that we live within, then we have to face the conclusion that if we're going to move into the future, right, this civilization needs to transform not in the superficials, not on the outside, not in the recycling bins and the electric cars, but like all the way through, right, from the very inside all the way through. All the things that have emerged in what, you know, some scientists are calling the Great Acceleration after World War II, you know, that's seen such an increase in various aspects of the human world, from population to carbon dioxide to nitrogen to all these things, acres of concrete, so on. Like, the whole civilization has to change so much, right, that basically the way we live now has to die, right? The way we live now is not sustainable. If we want to imagine the possibility of a real human future, this civilization has to transform into something else, right? Which is to say that this civilization has to die and a new one has to be reborn. That's the happy, positive side of it, right? The unhappy, like not so positive side of the question is just that if we can't do that, if we can't let go of the way that we live now and embrace a radically new future, then what we're going to just see is this civilization collapsing under its own weight and failures and inability to change, right? Because fundamentally, right, all that oil is being turned into, you know, carbon dioxide and pumped into the atmosphere, and it's overheating the planet, and it's going to, well, a range of second order effects are going to just make much of the planet uninhabitable for humans and so stress this wonderfully fine-tuned global infrastructure that it's going to collapse under its own weight. So those are the two ways, right, that this civilization could die. But either way, right, either way, it means the end of life as we know it.
You're tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Dr. Roy Scranton, author of the new book, We're Doomed, Now What? Essays on War and Climate Change. So in December 2015, you returned to the New York Times with kind of an update titled We're Doomed, Now What? That became a book just published by Penguin Random House in July 2018. The subtitle is Essays on War and Climate Change. Now, climate activists who came up through the peace movement have a hard time seeing that connection. You were kind of a war writer. Why are you talking now about climate?
Well, I'm talking about climate now for a couple of reasons. First is that, you know, before 2012, 2013, I actually hadn't been aware of how serious the situation was with climate change. A lot of people have this kind of moment of revelation where they read the IPCC reports or the World Bank reports, or they read a book like David Archer's The Long Thaw, you know, just where you take a moment to actually do some research on what scientists are saying, and you realize how severe the situation is, how enormous the obstacles are to transformation, and how unlikely it seems that we, whoever that we is, right, as a collective, as the human species, are going to be able to, like, actually do anything about it. That was kind of an existential moment, right? You know, not dissimilar to the moment when I decided to join the Army. Like, I was like, what do I do with this? Like, how do I make sense of this fact? I've spent this time in the Army to be able to go back to college and get a PhD so I could study and teach poetry, and then the world's ending. And now what? And so I started writing my way through it. And so that's basically sort of the way I came into it. You know, it's connected to my thinking and my work on war in a lot of ways. First of all, because climate change is, as the U.S. military knows, it's a conflict driver. It's connected to war in that kind of physical, direct way. But there's an interesting connection in that both climate change and war present really complex, interesting problems in terms of thinking about how we make meaning collectively, right? How we make meaning as a culture. War is interesting because there's so much sort of doublespeak and hypocrisy around it. It's interesting because it's a way of creating meaning in action, right, as well as in discourse. It undergirds much more of our culture than we tend to be aware of in a day-to-day way. And it's also a kind of, it's an easy atavistic go-to when we feel like our sense of meaningfulness is threatened, which we're going to see more and more of as climate change continues to emerge as the most significant global problem. But climate change is challenging in a bunch of other ways, you know, not least because of the scope of the problem, which is also a problem with war. It's a challenging problem because in distinction to war, it's not political in the sense that one can identify an enemy or a friend, right? Climate change is a much more complex problem in terms of, you know, which side are you on and who's complicit and who's culpable. you know, while it's easy to point the finger at and say, you know, there's so many corporations who are responsible for such and such percentage of climate change or carbon, and, you know, it's the rich and so on and so on, you know, especially for those of us who live in the United States, right, this is kind of a bad faith, right, finger pointing, because in fact, most of us are deeply invested in a very oil-rich way of life and are largely unwilling to make the sacrifices necessary to transform that. And then the problem arises, right? Like, even if we were willing to do so, that doesn't necessarily mean that it would change anything because, you know, there's still China and India and Russia and so on and so on, right? The world is not the United States. So all kinds of interesting conceptual problems that emerge when you start to think about climate change and how we're making sense of it, right, individually and as a culture.
For sure. My brain breaks down about some of the hypocrisy in my own life and in the people around me, even those who believe in climate change. So it's a difficult question. Now, on July 29, 2018, in a talk at the Commonwealth Club of California, you were paired with Episcopal priest and theologian Matthew Fox, and I've heard Matthew Fox speak. His website is climateone.org. And you said there, quote, "I'm all for despair. I think it's a good place to be." Could you please help us understand that?
We're afraid of despair. I think we're afraid of loss and sadness and grief. I think we live in a culture that tells us 1,000 times a day to keep moving and to feel happy and to focus on the positive and enjoy yourself. You know, I think that's often pretty diluted, and I think it's especially diluted when it comes to thinking about global climate change. You know, the situation is, even if we were to stop emitting carbon entirely right this minute all over the world, we're still probably in for another couple degrees of warming, right? And that's catastrophic. That would be catastrophic for the world we live in, right? Coral reefs, even if we stopped emitting carbon all over the world right now, the coral reefs would probably still die, right? Ocean fish populations would probably still be decimated. The Arctic would still be radically transformed. We've possibly, and maybe even probably, already passed significant tipping points to a kind of runaway warming. And that's all baked in, right? That's all because of the time lag between when we put the carbon into the atmosphere and the effects of that carbon emerging in the global climate. So even if, like, we were somehow able to, like, win this battle to stop climate change today, and we're dancing in the streets, it's a Pyrrhic victory at best, right? Because we still lose so much. We lose the seasons that we're used to. We lose plant life and animal life. You know, we're going to lose a lot of people, a lot of our fellow human beings, right? There's still so much loss. And until we start to reckon with that loss, and still until we start to make sense of the mass extinction going on right now, until we start to internalize and accept the suffering that climate change is causing and is going to cause, we are never going to be able to think clearly about it, right? Because our first thought is going to be to push away those things that make us afraid or sad or fill us with despair. Our first thought's always going to be reactive. It's going to be reacting against the things that we don't want to face. And so we're always going to be going sideways when we need to be in the moment that we're in. And that's why I think despair is not only a good place, I think it's a necessary place. I think it's really absolutely 100% necessary for us to sit with losing, to sit with defeat, to sit with loss and grief and suffering and our own complicity and guilt. We are part of the problem. I'm part of the problem.
Yep.
I can't make that go away. And then, you know, maybe if we sit with that and think about it, then we realize that there's still something we can do to help people around us.
So that's my next question. I mean, your new book is titled We're Doomed, and we've covered that somewhat. And then it says, now what? And do you have some answers to that question now, what, or is that an open question for all of us?
I'll be honest, Alex, the title is more of a provocation than a suggestion that I have a kind of, you know, 12-point plan as to how we should live with, you know, the collapse of human civilization and the death of so much that we love. I think it's a process, and I think we have to face it is the first thing, right? We have to come to terms with the situation. The hour is later than we think it is, right? We've already lost more than we thought we had, and we need to catch up with ourselves. That's the first thing. After that, once we start to do that, we can start to think about how to move into this new future with compassion and some sort of ethical responsibility, right? We're in this together, and we need to start thinking about how we're going to deal with, you know, emergent autocracy or xenophobia, climate-driven displacement and conflict. We need to start thinking about how we deal with this, not in the sense that, like, oh, we're just going to fix climate change and everything's going to be okay, but, like, how do we live in a broken world that's going to keep getting worse? What does an ethical life mean in that situation? And then if we have the time, if we have the luxury at the end of the day, we can start thinking about what we might do for the future, right? If there's going to be some kind of human future, what do we pass on to them? How do we help them? You know, they're going to be dealing with problems that we can't even imagine at this point. We have some obligation, I think, to pass on what we can and to do what we can to help them. But how we do that isn't entirely clear.
So at Duke University in North Carolina, you're supposed to talk with the celebrated Indian author Amitav Ghosh. And in 2016, I interviewed him about his book, The Great Derangement, Climate Change and the Unthinkable. Do you have expectations about where your conversation with Amitav might go?
I've been in conversation with Amitav over the past year, and he's always a bracing and challenging interlocutor because he doesn't really respond to kind of American pieties that we have to find a solution or that, like, that there needs to be some kind of, like, positive spin at the end of things. And he's also, his worldview is deeply connected to South Asia and Asia in ways that I always find really informative. He's able to see how climate change is changing the political situation in China and in India and how that relates to American politics in ways that I find always really enlightening. It's hard to know exactly what we'll wind up talking about. Probably, you know, some politics and some philosophy and some, you know, we'll probably field some questions from people who insist that, like, we need to do something now. And we'll probably both say, well, we're past that point. So I look forward to it quite a lot.
I would like to hear it. I hope it's put out as some sort of podcast or recorded. So look, as we wrap up here, Roy Scranton, do you see yourself as part of a community of like-minded thinkers? Who else are you in touch with who are thinking the way that you do?
I mean, I definitely consider Amitav an important colleague, fellow traveler, if you will. Dale Jameson is another. I feel like Elizabeth Colbert's work is very sympathetic, although I haven't had the opportunity to meet her in person. I don't know if she would agree, but I think there's a deep pessimism about humanity in the subtext of her work that I find very sympathetic. There are many others. Some of my colleagues here at Notre Dame, like Julie Adnay Thomas and Laura Walls. There's a young writer named Samuel Miller McDonald, who's doing a lot of interesting work, short pieces so far, but I'm looking forward to seeing what he's doing on climate change and conflict. There are others in various respects.
You've given us some good tips. And along those lines, do you have a website, a Facebook page, or a Twitter feed you want to tell our audience about so they can find out more?
Sure. My website's royscranton.com, and my Twitter is just @RoyScranton.
We've been speaking with a former soldier, a poet, and now author, Roy Scranton, and I'll put links to his new book, We're Doomed, Now What?, and other info in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org, or as he says, you can check out royscranton.com. Roy, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me on, Alex. It's a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. let's squeeze in the latest with three of America's top climate scientists talking about how climate change and the melting Arctic are part of the global heat in the summer of 2018 here in the Northern Hemisphere. This recording was brought to us via Maria Gallardon of TUC Radio, San Francisco. Thank you, Maria. And it was a Skype conference hosted by climatesignals.org.
TUC Radio, time of useful consciousness. How is climate change affecting the recent heat waves? At the end of July 2018, climatesignals.org brought together three eminent climate scientists via Skype. They exchanged ideas on the impacts of global warming as they are now, quote, playing out in real time. Mike Mann is director of the Earth System Science Center at Pennsylvania State University. Jennifer Francis is research professor at Rutgers University's Institute of Marine and Coastal Sciences. And Noah Diffenbaugh is the Kara J. Foundation professor at Stanford University. They discuss the recent heat waves around the globe and how they connect with a changing jet stream pattern. First to comment is Professor Michael Mann. Here's his response to the question, how is climate change affecting the recent heat waves? He's followed by Professor Jennifer Francis.
I'm happy to take the first stab at that. You know, it's not rocket science. You make the Earth hotter, you're going to have more extreme heat. You're going to have longer periods of extreme heat. You're going to have more intense heat. And that's what we're seeing. And it's not surprising that as we continue to warm the planet, as we continue to put these greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, so make the planet warmer, you're going to have more prolonged periods of intense heat. You're going to have more extreme heat. And that's what we're seeing this summer. The impacts of climate change are no longer subtle. We're seeing them play out in real time. And what's happening this summer is an excellent example. When you look at the intense heat, the unprecedented wildfires, floods, droughts. Now, there are other mechanisms that may be at work here as well. It isn't just that a hotter planet is going to produce more frequent and intense periods of heat, but we may be changing the circulation of the atmosphere. And our own research suggests that climate change, and in particular, the melting of Arctic sea ice and the warming of the Arctic, is actually changing the jet stream in a way that leads to more persistent extreme meanders in the jet stream in the summer. And that gives us these blocking high pressure systems where we see intense heat. It gives us these troughs, these low pressure areas that stay put day after day, giving us excessive rainfall and extreme flooding. So it isn't just the fact that a warmer planet is warmer. It's also changing the atmospheric circulation in a way that may be giving us these very persistent extreme events.
So I would just jump in and add that over the last week and maybe longer, we've seen the exact kinds of patterns that Mike is describing, where we've had this very undulating jet stream in place with big north-south swings all around the Northern Hemisphere, particularly over the continents. And it's tough to relate it directly to what's going on in the Arctic, but it's certainly consistent with what Mike is describing. In addition to those big undulations, we've also seen the jet stream split over North America and over Europe. And if you look at a map of the jet stream today or any time over the last week or two, you'll see that the split characteristic has been there. And when I say split, I mean part of it is going to the north and traveling along the basically the coast of the Arctic, and the other part is farther south. And some of Mike's research and his colleagues have suggested that when the jet stream does this split type of a feature, it tends to trap the weather patterns, the weather systems between those splits, and makes them very stagnant and persistent. And they've connected that to a lot of the most extreme events that we've seen over the last couple of decades. That kind of mechanism seems to be playing a role and increasing over time.
That was Dr. Jennifer Francis. Next up is Noah Diffenbaugh.
One of the real threats of heat waves is not just the very hot temperatures that we see in the daytime, but the fact that night temperatures don't drop to comfortable levels, to levels that allow us to sleep comfortably, it actually becomes a severe health threat, especially for the elderly and the young. When temperatures just don't cool down, your body doesn't have a chance to recuperate from the extreme heat that you've experienced during the daytime. We just set a record in North Africa for the highest low temperature, the highest nighttime minimum temperature on record, 109 degrees Fahrenheit. That was the lowest temperature that was seen in a location in Africa. And 109 degrees Fahrenheit is hot enough just as a daytime maximum temperature, but that was a nighttime minimum temperature. That is a real health threat, obviously. We have difficulty coping with that sort of extreme heat, especially when it stays warm throughout the night, like it's doing this summer in many regions.
And especially in countries that don't have access generally to cooling, air conditioning, or, you know, any relief from that kind of a heat.
That's right.
So I think one thing that, you know, is important to keep in mind as these individual events unfold, one is that as scientists, we're, you know, very careful to diagnose each event individually and the conditions that create each event individually. And overall, globally, what we're seeing is exactly what has been predicted for decades. So the warming of the planet as a whole is leading to warming of individual regions. The warming of those individual regions is upping the odds that when heat waves happen, that they're hotter, more severe. It's upping the odds that the atmospheric and ocean conditions that create heat waves, when those conditions occur, that they produce more severe events, in some cases more prolonged events. This is the warming of the nighttime temperatures, you know, that we're seeing. This is also a very robust prediction of a warming climate. So these are all at the global scale, you know, what we should expect, and in fact, what has been predicted for decades. So not only is it consistent with global warming, but it's exactly what has been forecast.
Yeah, to add to that, it's sort of troubling as a scientist when you're studying this major threat, the threat of human-caused climate change. It's disconcerting in a sense to see our predictions coming true, because of course we warned of this decades ago, and had we acted on climate change decades ago, we wouldn't be seeing the extreme and dangerous weather events around the world that we're seeing this summer. So that's a huge lost opportunity, the fact that we didn't act on this problem decades ago when we knew it was emerging. The good news is that there is still time to avert even more catastrophic impacts on climate change, even more deadly extreme weather events. But obviously we have to act now. We have to shift away from fossil fuels to renewable energy.
And I would just add to that some of the impacts of these extreme events are unfolding and starting to affect people and the ecosystem in very expensive and damaging ways. So if there's any silver lining to this dark cloud, it would be that I think more and more people now are recognizing that the impacts are affecting them personally, and that more and more we can connect what's going on to the changing climate system. So every poll that I see that comes out that measures what fraction of the population, especially in the United States, believes whether climate change is having an impact and whether humans are causing it, that number keeps growing. And I think it's partly because of these damaging extreme events, and it's costing people money, it's costing people lives, it's costing their own property, and climate change is affecting people today. It's not this distant problem for their grandchildren.
Who are you going to believe, the climate change denying talking head on Fox News or your own two eyes?
Those eyes have to be open, however.
That's right. And that's what we're all trying to do, make sure that people do open their eyes.
Mm-hmm. You are listening to a conversation between three climate scientists, recorded by Skype on July 27, 2018. They are Mike Mann, Director of the Earth System Science Center at Pennsylvania State University, Jennifer Francis, research professor at Rutgers University's Institute of Marine and Coastal Sciences, and Noor Diffenbau, Kara J. Foundation professor at Stanford University. The discussion was organized by Climate Signals and moderated by Markea Thomas. Here's her next question about the media. Michael Mann is the first to respond.
So what's something reporters don't understand about heat waves?
It's easy to comprehend, to understand that as you warm up the planet, you're going to get more intense heat. But that's just sort of the simple part of the problem. In reality, climate change, as we've talked about, is also changing the behavior of the jet stream. It's changing the atmospheric circulation. It may be leading to more of these blocking high-pressure systems that remain stationary. And that's when you get unprecedented heat spells, when the same high-pressure region covers Europe or North America day after day and the sun continues to bake those regions. That's when you get unprecedented heat waves. And so it's really a few different things working together. Just the fact that higher global temperatures mean more intense heat periods, more extended periods of heat, and the fact that we're changing the pattern of the atmospheric flow in a way that gives us those stagnant air masses that are associated with unprecedented heat, like what we've seen in Europe this week.
And as a result of those very rich, comprehensive observations, we can now test hypotheses about how global warming potentially influences individual extreme events around the world. And what we find, you know, when scientists conduct those objective, skeptical analyses, testing those rigorous hypotheses, what we find is that global warming has already put a thumb on the scale for a number of different kinds of extremes. Around the world, we find a human fingerprint of global warming at more than 80% of the surface area of the globe for the hottest temperature on record. And so for the hottest heat event, global warming has already put a thumb on the scale at more than 80% of the world. So we're not yet at the point where every single record hot event clearly has a human fingerprint, but we're getting awfully close.
Let me add one cautionary note here. You know, the sort of work that NOAA and other scientists have done in attempting to attribute to human activity of these extreme events is very important work. And it has helped inform our understanding of how climate change is indeed stacking the deck towards these more extreme events. But those analyses, of course, can be no better than the models that are used to conduct them. And climate models have come a long way, and there's reason to take their predictions very seriously. But there are certain areas where the models may not be as reliable as other areas. And one of those areas does have to do with the behavior of the jet stream, and in particular this phenomenon that my colleagues and I have been studying that's called planetary wave resonance, but it has to do with the fact that under certain circumstances, the jet stream can undulate more wildly than normal. You get larger meanders in the jet stream, and those meanders are very stable. They don't lose energy, and so they build, and they can sort of stay in place day after day. And you get these very persistent weather events, very persistent low-pressure areas with extreme rainfall, very persistent high-pressure regions with extreme heat, and they stay in the same location day after day. Our analyses suggest that the state-of-the-art climate models used, for example, in the most recent assessment of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, are not yet at the point where we can actually diagnose this phenomenon in the models themselves. We have to turn to other alternative approaches, more process-based approaches, to understand how climate change may be impacting those types of phenomena. And our own analyses suggest that because of that, the models may be overly conservative. When we use the models to assess the human impact on extreme weather events, they may not be capturing, in fact, we're fairly confident that they're not capturing, this other component that is adding to the increase in these extreme weather events.
And I would just follow up with the original question that you asked about what the media doesn't understand completely, perhaps, and that is, it goes back to what Mike was describing, how when you've got one kind of extreme in one place around the Northern Hemisphere, most likely you're going to find extremes of other types also occurring at the same time because of these undulations that happen in the jet stream. So those waves in the jet stream, those north-south swings in the jet stream, are what create the weather around the northern hemisphere that we all experience down at the surface. And when it's crazy and bizarre in one place, say a heat wave in one area, you can bet that somewhere else it's overly cold, which in the summer doesn't get reported because everybody's happy about that. But you'll also find areas that are getting persistent rain, and that's been happening, for example, along the Atlantic seaboard. You know, Washington, D.C. has been pretty much underwater for the last couple of weeks. So I think that's something that the media doesn't really understand too well yet, but I think, you know, we're working on you, and I think, you know, more and more we're finding some of the journalists that we talk to often are really understanding this now.
Yeah, I would add to that just some specific examples of what Jeff was describing. When you have these very unusual jet stream patterns, you have unusual weather that's correlated in, around the entire hemisphere. And while Japan was experiencing record flooding, parts of Europe and North America were experiencing record heat. In 2010, when Moscow had this unprecedented heat and these unprecedented wildfires, Pakistan was experiencing their worst flooding on record. That isn't a coincidence. It's because these perturbations in the jet stream have a hemispheric scale, and we see extreme weather all around the entire northern hemisphere, like we are seeing this July.
That was Professor Michael Mann adding to the intriguing question of how the meanders of the jet stream affect our weather. Next up is moderator Markea Thomas with her last question.
And what would you like to see covered more in the media? What should they be talking about?
Well, I think Jennifer just made an excellent point. It's the fact that these aren't coincidences. These aren't isolated coincidences that we're seeing these extreme weather events all around the northern hemisphere right now, this summer. It's part of a coherent change in the atmospheric circulation that almost certainly has a climate change component to it. What is good is that we are seeing the media start to connect the dots when it comes to climate change and extreme weather. The extreme weather we're seeing right now this summer, clearly we can see the fingerprint of human activity in these extreme weather events. And some media outlets have connected the dots, too many have not. In fact, there was an analysis last week that looked at sort of the prestige press and the legacy media, sort of our main media outlets in the United States. And very few of them actually commented on climate change as they covered these unprecedented extreme weather events. We've got to get better at that. We have to bring the journalistic community along in recognizing that they do have a responsibility to connect those dots, because that's where the rubber hits the road. When it comes to the threat of climate change, the damage that's being done by climate change, we have to understand that it isn't some subtle, far-off problem, polar bears in the Arctic. It is destruction and loss of life and massive upheaval where we live today, associated with extreme weather events that have been made more extreme by climate change.
And I would just add, I think it's a huge communication opportunity as well, because the public loves to hear about extreme weather. I mean, it's everybody loves talking about the weather. The headlines are the extremes, the damage, and so forth. Then if you can make that connection to some aspect of climate change, in, you know, a reasonable way, in some way that, you know, doesn't extend the science too far, it's that opportunity to connect with the public, because you've already got them listening with the extremes that are happening. And then you can slide a little spinach into the cheeseburger, is how I like to think of it. So the cheeseburger is the extreme event. Everybody loves that. And then you just slip a little spinach in there and you educate the public gradually about how science is learning that what you just witnessed as an extreme event does have this component that's contributed by climate change.
Let me just riff briefly off of the eloquent statement by Jennifer. Not only can we talk about the weather, we can actually do something about it.
Yeah.
We can do something about the path that we're on towards more extreme and deadly weather events. We can change that path by acting on climate change.
And for more information about heat waves and extreme heat, head to climatesignals.org and be sure to follow Climate Signals on Twitter.
That's all the time we have this week on Radio EcoShock. Join us next week for climate expert Will Steffen plus Bob Henson from the Weather Underground. My blog for this program is at ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.